All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And we thought we were done, but Keith pulled us back in. We're going to be talking more about The Godfather tonight as we do the 200th episode. This is some kind of thing to celebrate of the Actual Anarchy Podcast. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/200. That's 200. And speaking of two zeros, you got myself, Daniel Elwood, your host, and my co-host, Robert Johnson. And how you doing there, Robert? What's the big news down at the entrepreneurial business front?
Since yesterday, when we recorded the last episode and you asked me this question, not much, Daniel. We've got some new systems online. The new POS system is really helping us out, so that's nice. We've got a new kitchen printer. This is all stunning content. But yeah, things are smoothing out in the business itself, which is nice. There's the possibility of a loan being gotten. For the food trailer, so that's exciting. So things are progressing, and we're moving ahead. That's
well,
the
actually,
best news I can give you.
This is very interesting stuff because those new implements, those investments, those capital investments, are going to improve the speed and quality in which you can provide the services that you do for your customers. So it's a example of investing to make your product better, so that your consumers are happier. I think that's really good.
Yeah. And companies, businesses do it all the time, Daniel. It's not anything new. You constantly have to up your game. You know, you want to make the life of yourself and your employees better. So it allows each person to be more efficient. It reduces stress in the workplace, thereby making your business more efficient, making it more attractive to employees and to consumers. It's a win-win-win all the way around.
So you can exploit them even more. It's a great thing. Well, speaking of exploiting, we're going to exploit the crap out of the Godfather trilogy as we get into the last narrative portion of the show, and we're going to introduce our guest in just a few moments. We'll be back right after these moments and messages and things. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are The Last Nighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. And tonight, we're going to be revisiting the Godfather trilogy. We had a conversation with our buddy Keith Knight talking about Godfather Part 1 and Godfather Part 2 a couple of weeks ago, and that was episode, I want to say, 140 of the show. And we're going to continue the conversation because we ran out of time and we didn't get to the review portion, and we had a few more points to make. So we're going to do that tonight on the 143rd. Episode of the show. You can find the show notes more at lastnighters.com/143. And this is going to be a fun one, I think. We had a whole bunch of stuff we had at the end of the last one we wanted to talk about. And now that we've reconvened during the pre-show, we've all realized we forgot everything we wanted to talk about. So this could be a terrible episode. It could be a good episode. We don't know. So without further ado, we'll introduce our great guest. It's Keith Knight of Don't Tread on Anyone. He's been with us many times in the past. And one of the most recent episodes, of course, is Godfather, the first conversation that we had with you. You were also on for Castaway, and that was over a year ago with Tom Hanks. And we had a really good conversation about anarcho-primitivism and just using scarce resources to achieve your ends and all of those things. So it's almost like we were doing that Peter Schiff book. You know the name of it, right?
How an economy grows and why it crashes.
Yeah, you know the thing and the rest of it, right? Yeah. Well, welcome, Keith. Why don't you just remind everyone, I mean, everyone go back and listen to episode 140 and you'll get the whole rundown of what Keith does. But he does Don't Tread on Me, the YouTube channel, and he's also on BitChute and other social media platforms. And he has over 500 videos. Many of them are compilations he's put together, and many other ones are him having conversations with people and a bunch of other really, really good stuff. So Keith, just take a moment to do the elevator pitch, and then we'll get into the episode here.
Well, if I may correct you, it's not Don't Tread on Me. The show is called Don't Tread on Anyone. I am ripping off libertarianism, not conservatism. Want to make that very clear. Trying to take the conservative principle and apply it universally. I think anytime we take generally good principles, apply them universally, we end up with a libertarian, anarchist, voluntarist, natural law ideology. That's what I try to promote on my channel. Please check it out. I have videos ranging from 15 seconds where I try to make a quick point to 5 hours and 10 minutes.
All right, and that 5 hour and 10 minutes is the ultimate red pill, if I'm correct. And yeah, as you were saying in the pre-show, which is available for Patreon supporters at lastnighters.com/Patreon, sorry. That one is 5 hours of length, and you were saying that it's about the length of a child's school day. And so the idea there was that as long as they can give you at least one day versus the state taking 12 years of such days, you can basically red pill them against all the indoctrination that they receive.
Oh, yeah. All you need is a little truth to beat a bunch of falsifiable lies. So I definitely put that challenge to people. If you can watch that video and still think that there is a coherent argument for the state, well, please let me know about it at keithknight130@gmail.com. I've been waiting for about 10 years to come across this argument. Still haven't gotten it. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's me and I haven't heard it. But yes, please let me know.
All right. Keith has thrown down the gauntlet. So he's taking all comers. Listen to that.
Is there a $10,000 reward for somebody that submits the best, the real argument for actual state necessitation?
Because Robert's not bored. He'll do it.
There is a $1 million offer. I will put my house up and enslave myself. If anyone is able to prove a contradiction, I will be so shocked that I wouldn't mind working off the $1 million for the rest of my life.
There you got it, statists. There you go.
All right. Wow.
Free money.
Wow. I can't believe that this has now turned into Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? All right. I'm dating myself here. All right. Well, let's get into this. And we will, of course, have links to your prior appearances and your work on the show notes page at lastnighters.com/143. And we will get into the Google description. Last time I read the description for The Godfather. And let me see if I can make this on screen. The technical know-how here is Biden-esque. All right, you guys can see this?
Yes.
All right. So here we go. The Godfather, 1972, rated R, drama/crime film, 2 hours and 58 minutes in length. So it's a long one. 9.2 IMDb, 98% Rotten Tomatoes, and 100% of Metacritic users liked it, and 93% of Google users liked it. The description is short and sweet. It is The Godfather is a 1972 American crime film directed by Francis Ford Coppola, who co-wrote the screenplay with Mario Puzo, based on Puzo's best-selling 1969 novel of the same name. Came out March 24, 1972, director Francis Ford Coppola, and it won a bunch of awards and is often hailed as one of the great cinematic masterpieces, and it's hard to argue with that. So let's go over to Robert for your opening take on, I guess, this one. Where we left off last time.
What? So I'm re-talking about The Godfather again? Exactly. Is that what we're doing?
Well, is there anything that you recall? Let's do it this way.
I got a bunch of stuff, guys. So if you want me to start this way, I just want to pick a topic and have you guys respond to it. Is that okay?
All right, Keith has taken over. He's taken over the show. He's a game show host now. He's offered $1 million.
Warlords have taken over, just like normal anarchy. I knew it.
Okay. The first thing that comes to mind, just as you were reading that that description, is, well, it was a book. It was a movie made from a book. As far as intellectual property goes, what we're dealing with is copyright, trademark, trade secret, and patent rights. As far as intellectual property rights, taking something from a movie to a book, even without the express permission or consent of the original book author, where do you guys stand on intellectual property?
I will refer you to our previous episode from a couple of weeks ago about Gentlemen Broncos, where I discussed my thoughts on intellectual property for about an hour.
Well, give him the nutshell version, Daniel.
Can we not get a summary, please?
Give it to him, Daniel.
All right, I'll give it to you, Keith.
Get him, Steve, Dave.
Well, I think that you can have a contractual agreement with between parties, so you can sell certain rights to someone, and that binds that party to them. Also, that once you do sell something to someone, they can sort of riff on it from there, sort of like the rap game. And as Robert talked about on the bonus episode we did for Gentlemen Broncos, that often you need someone else's perspective to expand on the ideas, find the flaws in it, perhaps improve on it. And we noticed this in Gentlemen Broncos, that even though a film adaptation was being made from the rights that he sold, he was unhappy with the direction they were taking it. But they were actually adding a lot more drama and like a romance angle to it and all of those things. And oftentimes you can actually improve something. So I'm not sure if that really answers the question on trademark, copyright, patents. I'm against patents. I'm okay with copyright to a point within a limited contractual agreement. And if technology advances to the point where you can actually restrict what you're able to sell to someone, like if there was some technology that said, hey, there's some way to guarantee that only you, Keith, are the person who can view, utilize, whatever, be exposed to this work that I've created, and I sell it to you with that caveat, then I think it would be against the spirit of the agreement for you to then try to get around that or break that agreement.
Well, yeah, that's a voluntary contract. That's not what intellectual property is. Intellectual property involves unilateral agreements where A and B can get together and stop C from using his property with whatever he would like to do with it. Robert, do you have any thoughts on IP, considering it's probably one of the biggest things that internet companies can use to justify taking down any material that could be counted as copyright? And that's how they're able to target freedom advocates like ourselves.
Right. So like I think Daniel has said in the past, that it is using violence to intervene with a person using their own property for their own ends. So yeah, I'm absolutely against IP. Like Daniel was saying, you can form voluntary contracts and divvy out your ideas as you see fit. But once an idea is out there, once it's been released into the public consciousness, once you can read it or hear about it or anything like that, if someone's going to come along and stop you from acting on that new information, they are initiating aggression against you. So yeah, I'm completely against it. In that sense,
I would totally agree with that. I think it's really great that we've been able to sort of, humble ourselves and stop this thinking of, well, it's not that, we're just pro business or pro money or pro profit and all that stuff. We actually have a principled philosophy that once we nail down these terms, we're able to run everything through that sort of ideological spectrum and determine what is just and unjust. I agree with both of you. In the same way, if I steal your car, well, then I have taken it from your possession and you no longer are able to use it. But if I look at your car, create my own, and create 100 million others, yes, I've benefited from your labor, but the labor theory of value is illegitimate. You working does not impose an obligation on third parties to give you portions of their property or money or anything else. So therefore, only tangible, scarce, actual items are justly property. Intellectual property is illegitimate.
Indeed. Now, intellectual property is not scarce until it's been unreleased.
In this particular example, though, with this movie being adapted from a novel, the author of the novel participated in the making of the movie and was compensated for it. So in a voluntary arrangement. So in that way, there is a property interest. He is selling something to them. They're making a contractual agreement. So
right. But under the system of IP being a thing though, right? I mean, how it would have happened in a voluntary situation, we're not exactly sure. Like we would have been compensated maybe more or far less. We don't know. I mean, it would have been more like an advisor to them adapting this work, right? As opposed to, hey, we're going to get the exclusive rights to adapt this work into a film.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know how it would work, because maybe it'd just be like a professional courtesy kind of thing. Like, because someone could have read the book, and if there wasn't such a thing as a unilateral IP being imposed upon everyone, what would really prevent them from adapting it to something like, oh, I read this novel and it was really good, and so I decided to make this movie using the same ideas, same character, same everything.
But they might have wanted to hire Mario Puzo as the author of the book, because he would have a unique understanding and ideas and perspective on adapting it to a film situation. I mean, he would just be a wealth of knowledge in terms of if they had any kind of questions or ideas in terms of casting or set design or anything like that. He might have been well worth the money they paid. Or maybe not. Maybe the director's got his own idea and he wants to set it in space or on Mars and in the future. I mean, you don't know.
Godfather 4, Godfather in Space.
That's right, yeah, baby.
I think that's the next one.
That should be.
Well, Keith, I'm sure you've got a bunch of content on intellectual property, and we've done a bunch of episodes on it. Gentleman Broncos is the most recent one, and we refer to Kinsella's work and Boldrin and Levine's work against intellectual monopoly and against intellectual property. Both are really good books, well worth checking out. Now, if we can sort of tie this into sort of maybe a theme related to The Godfather, we sort of talked last time about a lot of the events that happened within the United States. And Godfather 1 and 2 both have elements outside of the country. And so maybe that's an area that we could sort of focus on. So last time we talked about like how Michael became from this naive, wide-eyed, you know, young whippersnapper into this transformation where he ends up killing Sollozzo. That's one of the key elements in him becoming the next Godfather. But I think it wasn't fully cemented until he went into hiding. I think it was in Sicily. And he ended up in a very stately way, like being betrothed to a girl there. Like he approached the father. It was like getting his blessing and his permission, you know, in a very like alpha bold move. And they end up getting married. And because of the repercussions of him shooting Sollozzo and the cop who was protecting him, the other crime families ended up infiltrating his guards. And one of them ended up planting a car bomb that was meant to kill Michael, and it ended up killing his wife. And I think that was the final straw that turned him into, all right, I'm going to assume the mantle, basically, at that point. So, Robert, what was your feeling about on the Italy scenes after Michael goes into hiding and his romance with Apollina?
Sorry, Daniel, I didn't hear a lot of those questions. My internet is crapping out, so I guess you asked me what I thought about the Italian scenes. I mean, from what perspective? From Michael's growth into the Godfather? Like, how did that? I mean, he was all alone. I mean, in New York, he had his brothers, he had his father. He basically had everybody that, you know, he's being talked over, especially with Sonny and his father. You know, when he's all alone in Sicily, he's basically becoming, I mean, he was in the military, but then even then you're just getting orders all the time. So I guess in Sicily, he's able to, you know, make his own decisions. He sees a woman that he likes. He really has time to reflect on the consequences, and he's really getting engendered into this mafia world. I don't know. I don't have a whole lot of hot takes on this. I hope I'm answering your question, but unfortunately I didn't hear a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, I think your point is that he sort of like found himself, he became the man that he was going to be. And then at the end of his trip or his time in Italy, they attempted to assassinate him with a car bomb. And it ended up killing his wife. And that was the thing that finally pushed him over and developed him into the next Godfather when he came back to the U.S.
Now, who was behind that car bomb again?
Yeah, I don't know if we ever know. I know it's a reprisal for him killing Sollozzo. And Sollozzo, I believe, was in league with the Tattaglias.
That's
so
right.
It must have been the Tattaglias. And this also brings me back to the whole engagement with Sollozzo when he starts talking to Vito, older Vito, the Marlon Brando version. And he's like, I want to get into this drug racket. And Vito's like, hey, you know, all of these things that we are engaged in right now, they're not really crimes. And so the police sort of just kind of let us do it. You know, we pay them off or whatever and everything's fine. But when we get into the drug game, that's when it becomes more of a problem. Now, we would all argue that even the drug thing shouldn't be a crime. But, you know, the gambling and the prostitution and all of those things, they're more like vices, really. And so that's why the police were kind of okay with it. But Marlon Brando's Vito was like, I don't want to get involved in the drug game because then you're getting into real police reaction to that. And so he turned down Sollozzo, I think, in a very respectful way. But for whatever reason, Sollozzo took offense to it and ended up reacting with trying to cause harm to Vito and the Corleones.
Indeed. Yeah, he did. And mostly is due to him not wanting to share his politicians and judge contact, right?
Right. Yeah. Because Vito had a lot of the, like in our last episode, we talked about Hotel Rwanda, where Paul had all these like connections and leverage the ability to call in favors and whatnot. And so he was trying to use those to save his family from the Rwandan genocide. I think similarly, Vito had a lot of those same types of like greased palms and favors owed and those types of things. And he was holding those close to the chest, where these other five families of New York, the other four, were like, we want a piece of that. You know, we want what you have and you're not sharing it.
Right. And it seemed to be, and you get a sense of Vito's ability to engender favors from his time as a young hood in New York in Hell's Kitchen, when he's like developing into the Don, right? When he gets this, his wife has a friend who gets kicked out of her apartment, or the landlord wants to kick her out of the apartment for having this dog situation. The dog's causing too much noise. And Vito ends up calling in this guy, and he basically tries to see what he can do for him. And this is, seems to be his common business tactic of, hey, let's form a bond here where I owe you favors and then you can owe me favors. And then we're just like helping each other. And this very much seems to form this kind of web of strings that he could pull at any given time. It's a pretty brilliant way to go about doing business, even though as an immoral of a business that he's in, where he actually, you know, will threaten to kill people, or he will actually kill people. In terms of networking, it's a pretty brilliant strategy. And I think it's been used successfully by businessmen since business was invented tens of thousands of millions of years ago.
That's interesting, because that's the exact strategy he pulls with the guy in part one, when, you know, he's his older version of himself, where the guy says, these two guys, you know, they mistreated my daughter severely. I need help. How much shall I pay you? And, you know, he goes, well, how dare you insult me? You know, you think I'm all about money? Never have you, you know, asked me for your friendship. God, am I butchering this fucking scene? I'm sorry. The point is that the guy says, hey, I'm here to offer you a deal. He goes, this isn't about money. Now, there is an anarcho-capitalist position to this. The idea that capitalism or free markets are all about money, total misconception. In fact, it's actually the socialist who is extremely materialist. Give me your property or I'll put you in a cage or murder you if you resist. Yeah, they're the materialists. The capitalist, the free market libertarian, actually sees value and sees human beings as individuals in and of themselves that have rather inherent value, if you will. We also see very high degrees of charity in capitalist nations, places that have much more market-based economies. Maybe it's because they're wealthier. But certainly, it would be the equivalent of saying anyone who believes in voluntary intercourse believes that everyone should be promiscuous. Not at all. The fact that I believe in voluntary exchange doesn't mean I believe everyone should be materialist, any more than the fact that I believe there should be voluntary marriages means that I support people getting divorced and married and divorced and married. So what we are attracted to about these characters is that they're not just power hungry, money obsessive psychos. They actually do have an appreciation for their family. Michael's biggest thing is not that he lost money once. It's that his son was aborted and his legacy will not live on. I think that's an important part that we really see throughout parts one and two that is generally underappreciated when people reference things like capitalism or even the mafia, to be fair.
Yeah, those are really good points, Keith. And to go back to that very opening scene, I think it's a very strong cinematic opening where his name's Bonacera, and he's an undertaker. And a favor gets called in later when Sonny dies. But you're right. It isn't just that it's money being offered in exchange for the Godfather's help with the perpetrators who attacked Bonacera's daughter. It's the respect, and it's the friendship, and it's like a subjective value thing. Like, money isn't everything. You get compensated in so many ways. Money is just a proxy for being able to achieve satisfactions or goals with your resources, and so some of those satisfactions can be respect or friendship or a good conversation or whatever. You know, it could be anything, and that's a profit. It's still a profit, even though it doesn't show up on a profit and loss, you know, like actuarial table or whatever. But you know, so it is more than just money. And the other aspect of that opening scene is that he even mentions he went to the police and they went to court and they charged the guys and they got a slap on the wrist for raping and disfiguring his daughter. And he wanted actual justice. And so that's why he went to the Godfather, because he was not able to get justice from the monopoly justice provider in his geographic area. So I'll go to Robert first with your riff on that, and then we'll let Keith run for like 10 minutes.
Why do you only ask me when the internet craps out and I don't get to hear the whole question? You asked me something about how the Undertaker was unable to get justice for his daughter with the current monopoly justice system. Yeah, and then goes to the Godfather for the real justice, and he's like filling in where the monopoly system doesn't, where it fails. This is just a black market, right? Black market injustice. And in a free society, all things would be permissible. Well, not necessarily, not all things would be permissible, but there wouldn't be a monopoly on the justice system, or they would be resultant. They would be, well, I guess in this sense that, well, no, because they're still getting paid, but they would be, subject to market forces. So, you know, where they don't satisfy his desire for justice, he could go to somebody else. Gosh, I'm really kind of butchering my answer here. I'm not really sure what I got, but I'm sure Keith could fill me in and bail me out here. He's a mastermind. I'll just defer, because unfortunately my internet is just not, it keeps freezing you guys, and I'm trying to get on what you say, but I can't get all. Sorry.
So the general point is made by Hans Hoppe, where he says it's amazing that all the economists of the world will say monopolies are bad, and they'll say this is bad because it results in higher prices and fewer options. But they never take that stance they claim to have and apply it to the state. So when the state provides coercively funded justice, as they call it, well, obviously, what you're going to get is worse options because you have fewer alternatives and you don't really have the incentive to meet consumer demand. Because if everyone's unhappy with you, well, you still get funded. As we see in cases like Gonzalez versus Castle Rock, Warren v. District of Columbia, you have blatant examples of the police not protecting people openly. We have 90 days of riots and the police openly not only don't protect you if you go outside of your house like the couple in Missouri to just show people you're going to defend your own property you've worked your entire life to build. Well, they're going to prosecute you. This is exactly what we would expect with a coercively funded monopoly that you're not able to opt out of. So this gives you a small insight where the state protects the aggressors. Today, it's the rioters. It's also the politicians who start wars based on lies. The politicians steal trillions. They enslave millions for a fake drug war half the time they're planting evidence. Now, on the other hand, the victim is hardly ever considered. It's like, you know what? We are going to put them away for 25 years. Even in that case, the victim is not made whole. So the fact that we don't have a justice system based on taking money or labor from the aggressor and giving to the victim is a total shortcoming, because if anyone should be compensated, it's the victim. Instead, the victim is taxed to pay for these jails and everything else, of course. There's no incentive to meet consumer demand, which is why people are so generally unhappy with it, which is why they've more or less just accepted it, because the reality is the vast amount of injustice that has gotten away with, if they don't really have this sort of compensate the victim rule of thumb, well, then we would see how many things are actual victimless crimes, whether it's not obeying regulations, not chipping in for the welfare state, not chipping in for the warfare state, using drugs, all this other stuff. That is my general idea on the illegitimacy of not only the state, but it claiming a monopoly over a system of justice.
So all right. Let me ask you guys, I'm going to ask each of you, do you support Vito in his saying that if he had come to him and as friendship, these guys already would have been taken care of? I'd be happy to do it. I think that if anybody raped and almost beat to death my daughter, I would have no issue with going to anybody who was going to seek, take care of justice for me. Daniel, do you see anything wrong with Vito in this situation taking care of justice?
No, I think that Vito is actually providing justice in this particular situation. And these guys had already been, I believe, found guilty in a court of law. So it's like even double, confirmed, right? Like beyond a reasonable doubt, these guys have been found guilty and they got a slap on the wrist for whatever reason. So it's essentially confirmed that this happened and these were the guys. So I really don't have a problem with Vito taking care of it.
Keith, you have any issues, qualms?
Not at all. In this case, we have severe aggression against what we're assuming is an innocent person. So the act of, I guess you would call it retaliation, creates one and a disincentive for further aggressors to partake in the action. Also, you're narrowly focusing the retaliation on the aggressors themselves. So this is not to be at all confused with Iran did X, therefore we get to invade Iran, as collectivist Leonard Peikoff, head of the Ayn Rand Institute, calls Iran a terrorist nation. What we have here is actually them being able to focus on the aggressors, create a disincentive for future aggressors, and this, unfortunately, is the only justice you're going to get. Ideally, you would either take a portion of their property and allocate it to the victim. The cost of doing so would be extraordinarily high, especially when the state already monopolizes the court system, I will call it, because there's no justice except justice for the criminal bankers, politicians, and executives at Raytheon. So because we have these two standards, it is creating a disincentive for future individuals to participate in the crime, and you're focusing narrowly on the actual aggressors, I believe their retaliation is justified. And it's privately funded. It's not funded through taxation or coercive gatherings.
Well, it is funded through Vito's business dealings. And those may be done through theft and whatever else. But yeah, I get your point. I get your point for sure. Daniel?
Yeah, so if we could go back to Salazzo being turned down, and it seemed to be in a respectful way and for legitimate reasons, I guess, what is the justification that Salazzo has to then attack Vito? Like, because that's really not going to get him the connections that Vito has, right? If Vito's dead, well, I guess they would leave those politicians and those connections like without a connect anymore, and so I guess they'd become available on the market, so to speak, of underhanded dealings. But it really just seemed like a betrayal. Like they're all about being respectful to each other and having cordial conversation. But as we were talking in the previous episode, Robert, you were like, you always have to be wary about the subtext and what are they really saying under what they're saying. And is this just an example of that? Like everyone was aware that on the surface, they're having a cordial conversation, but underneath it, they're all really sort of subtly saying, no, now we're at war. Now we're going to fight this out.
Yeah. If you watch the Godfather series, it's all about the subtext and all about reading the subtle cues and how Vito just knows things about it's going to be this guy who's going to betray you. He's going to pretend to be his friend, blah, blah, blah. He's just, so much is just known by things that just aren't said, right? Just by analyzing the situation and knowing the players and where they're at on the chessboard. Now, in terms of the war, I got to agree with you. A lot of wars, especially mafia wars, don't make a lot of sense, especially because this one wasn't for territory. Usually mafia wars are fought over territory. Sometimes they're fought over so-and-so, you know, disrespected so-and-so, and so-and-so touched so-and-so, and this guy's a made guy, and you're not supposed to touch made guys. You're violating the rule. So it's essentially kind of a rule law enforcement situation. But in this situation, yeah, you're right. I mean, Sollozzo, what does he get? He wants the judges. He wants the politicians. But killing Vito, I mean, all killing Vito does is give the reins to Sonny. And then Sonny's not going to be a reasonable guy. He's going to be pissed he killed his dad and started a war. So then you got to kill Sonny. So, and then you kill Sonny, and then maybe it falls to maybe Fredo, maybe Michael, probably Michael. And then maybe Michael will be more reasonable. But to be the aggressor and then to come back and, you know, invite people to sit down at the restaurant and disrespect to just be like, you know, be everything to be okay. And we're just going to sit down and be reasonable and, you know, everything's going to go back to normal is really kind of naive on Sollozzo's part. His ward just does not make a whole lot of sense. I don't think he knows who he's dealing with.
Yeah, and to that end, I think that that is kind of the narrative that's played out in the movie. It's been a couple of weeks since I watched this, but I think even Sollozzo says that to Michael. It's like, hey, I knew that Sonny wasn't going to be someone to deal with, so I was hoping to get to you and that you'll make the right decision. And so that's when Michael, who had already prepared to, you know, exact revenge for what they had done, for what Sollozzo and this police officer had done to him, there's this scene or that moment at the restaurant where Michael's not saying anything, but he has this intense look in his eye, and you can hear like a subway going by, like a train. It's like super loud. And it represents like the chaos going on in his head. Like this moment is about to happen. And all this tension is building. And this is echoed because this is like where he finally crosses that line, right? This is the breaking point that turns him into the next Godfather. And then all the stuff that we talked about in Italy is like kind of cements it. But in Godfather 3, which Coppola is actually releasing a new version of soon, and it's supposed to like correct for a lot of the critiques that people have for it, saying it's like it's the sequel that shall not be named. But at the end of Godfather 3, there's a moment where his daughter dies and he's on the steps of this opera house or whatever, and he starts screaming. But as an echo back to this moment in the restaurant where he kills Sollozzo, here he's screaming and there's no sound. So in the restaurant, he's perfectly quiet, but there's this scream, this building tension going on in his head, in his mind, as this moment's about to happen. And then in Godfather 3 at the very end, it's the, I guess he has a stroke, right? And he dies. He's screaming as of the result of his daughter dying from, you know, the repercussions of him repeatedly putting his family at risk. And the scream is silent. And so there's a nice like symmetry to that. And I was watching some of the bonus content, and the editor who was doing Godfather 3, he'd been like adjusting that scene over and over again, like watching it 25, 35 times. And finally he just said, you know what? I'm just going to make it silent and tie it back to where Michael became Michael. So now this is the end of Michael, and it's sort of the inverse. I think artistry, you know, that it's a yeah, serendipitous artistry thing. It's like a serendipitous thing. They didn't plan that.
Circular, sort of, rhymes.
Yeah, but it came to him inspirationally, like over the course of time, after the scenes had already been shot and after the, you know, script had already happened, you know. So this was like an inspirational artistic flourish that was added. And I think it adds a lot to it.
Oh, absolutely. No, editing is huge. You can transform a movie from one movie to a completely other movie in the editing room. Absolutely. They shoot, I mean, depending on the film, they can shoot sometimes, you know, 10 times more feet. Well, not digitally, but you know what I mean? Like way more time than is actually necessary for the film. So they could turn so much stuff. I mean, a lot of times actors will just shoot so much material and people will ask them, you know, what the movie's about. And they're like, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. It could be anything. I read, 17 versions of the script, and I don't even know if that's the final version. I just know we shot a whole bunch of stuff, and we'll see what happens when it comes out. I trust the people and the talented people that I worked with. And, I got good feelings about this one, but, you'll find out when I'll find out. That happens a lot.
Yeah. And that's pretty wild. I mean, and it is an evolutionary process, and it always surprises me. I mean, I've talked about it many times on the show before. Like, I can't believe they went into like producing this movie, shooting these scenes, and they're still like writing the script day of, and they don't know like some of the key points, and sometimes they fall down and they miss them. Yeah. And of course we call them out.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be watching the Snyder Cut, I'm sure. And that was, from what scenes you've seen the trailer, that looks so much different than what we saw.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, yeah. I mean.
Now, the interesting thing you mentioned about Sonny being sort of a hothead was, of course, introduced in the original Sollozzo meeting where he speaks up and Marlon Brando gets very upset. He says, well, my kids speak when they should listen. And then we see Sollozzo say this to Michael. And then we even see Vito say this to Michael later on when it's just them talking and drinking wine about, what a hothead Sonny is. This is a psychological principle that is generally those who are easily, you're never more vulnerable than when you're extremely angry. Those who are easily offended are therefore easily controllable. We see this all the time in the political realm. When they tell you to be offended at Iran said they want to blow Israel off the map. First of all, that's completely made up. Second of all, if we actually have a principle as to it's wrong to bomb nations, well, the second you apply that consistently, well, we see where that goes, and you recognize the people claiming to protect your own country actually engage in this activity much more so than they say the people you should be afraid of. But we see it completely controlling the leftists in the social justice movement as far as telling people when they should get angry. They should be angry by, an alleged guy resisting arrest for an actual violent crime. Finally, a violent crime, not one of this victimless crimes against the state that we so often hear. So what you actually have in politics is the intelligence agencies, as well as the media, issuing opinions to the populace, telling them to be mad at this, but not to be mad at that. The right gets very upset when they see the soldiers with their hands behind their head on the Iranian boats. That's something military officers do all the time when they come into conflict. When they come into contact with other groups, just to pat them down. It's like the TSA for overseas. I'm not saying it's just, I'm saying that happens all the time. Or they tell you to be really, really mad at the George Floyd stuff, but not at Kelly Thomas getting murdered on camera, which was a white guy, or Tony Timpa, where he was a white guy, where the cops stood on the back of his neck and suffocated him to death. They don't tell you to get, they tell you to get mad at Breonna Taylor, but not at the Duncan Lemp situation where he was murdered by the cops under the same conditions. So again, we see Sonny easily manipulated, Sonny heavy on emotions, therefore easily manipulated, leftists and rightists, because you can't, offend the police. You can't offend the military with the right wingers. The fact that they're so easily manipulated means they completely leave the realm of rational discussion and are easily manipulated by the media, the politicians, the intelligence agencies, the military officers, which is why they're so irrational and so inconsistent.
Yeah, good riff. And it's Indeed. Like a Pavlovian conditioning that's going on. Yuri Bezmenov, my favorite KGB defector, has a really good series of discussions about, demoralization and crisis and, basically this multi-decade process that goes into destabilizing a country into revolution. So I'll post a link to that because it's kind of what you're talking about.
If we could go back in time and kind of look at the origins of the mafia, La Cosa Nostra, the commission, it was, I believe, Lucky Luciano who formed the original commission in response to prohibition. So essentially the United States government, by a stroke of a pen, created the modern mafia. It seems to me, and they celebrated it. They were ecstatic because you're essentially artificially constraining the supply of a desired good. It's going to increase the value of that good, and it's going to take people that will take that risk to bring it to the people and give them enormous profits. So I got to wonder, even though Michael in this series does nothing but want to be legit, I mean, at least that's what he pays lip service to, is he wants to pretend to be legit or go legit, especially in the third one. But he kind of wants to be also in the second one. It seems to me that the mafia are some of the biggest statists around. They want these services that they provide to be illegal so that they can profit massively from them. If the state went away tomorrow, they would have to be, well, they would be just de facto legit businessmen at that point. And they would be, you know, their disputes would be, you know, able to be used by the private defense systems and that sort of thing. But do you think that they would resist, you know, the abolition of the state, or would they embrace it in general? I tend to think that a lot of these people, you know, gangs and mafia, don't necessarily want to be, but there's such a huge incentive to be that they kind of are willing to do that, especially younger, you know, angry, violent men. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts. Both you, Daniel, I'll go to you first.
Well, it sounds a lot to me like, companies in a certain industry being supportive of regulations that are hurdles and impediments to competition. And so you would think the big business is like against regulation or against government because it's restraining them. But really, I think in a lot of cases, they end up wanting the government to impose those things because it makes them more protected. It's protectionism. It makes it easier for them to not have to work as hard to provide as good a service, or they can charge higher prices. And so in the absence of the state, they'd actually have to really innovate and really compete and lower their prices and improve their quality and improve their level of service. So I think it's a lazy play, but it's convenient. And it's sort of like Walmart and the minimum wage. You know, they're fully supportive of the minimum wage because they can afford to pay it, and it's going to put the medium tier and lower tier shops out of business because they can't afford it. So I'll shift over to Keith.
Well, so as much as, say, like your average gangbanger hates the cops, they really do appreciate the fact that, you know, drugs and prostitution and whatnot are illegal. Is that what you're basically saying?
Oh, I don't know about on the street level. I mean, maybe. I mean, so many other opportunities have been prevented from being available that oftentimes those seem to be the only things that they can do. Sort of like the Somali pirate thing that we were talking about in Captain Phillips. It's like you've got all this regulation that's preventing people from, you know, starting businesses, licensing laws, permits, and those things. You've got minimum wage laws that are preventing people who can't provide as much value with their labor to make it worth somebody hiring them. So you've eliminated a lot of the opportunities that would have otherwise been there. And so then you're just left with, you know, what else is there? You have to kind of go illegitimate at that point to do some illegal stuff. So I don't know about on the street level, whether they are supportive of that, but the ones in the know, like the ones in positions of power, I'm sure that they are probably thinking, yeah, we like this being this way because otherwise this would be a straight, you know, competitive market that we would have difficulty competing in as well.
Yeah, I tend to think, and I'll go to Keith here in a second, but I tend to think that the street guys would probably be more unhappy with the cop situation, but the mid-level guys, the capos, those guys would be like, you know, they're removed from the street level violence for the most part. They're kind of like telling the soldiers and dictating them what to do. I think they're perfectly happy. And maybe at the Don level with Michael, maybe he's more, well, I'm a legitimate businessman. I got my reputation and my to think about and that kind of thing. But Keith, what's your take?
Yeah, you definitely have different levels of understanding as you go through the hierarchy of companies. So for example, the executives at Boeing, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman are very well aware that there is a military industrial complex in America that's been around since the days of Smedley Butler writing War's Racket, Eisenhower's military industrial complex speech. Donald Trump came out and explicitly said the reason we're friends with Saudi Arabia, even after they killed Khashoggi in I want to say this is the official White House statement, December of 2018 statement on Khashoggi. He explicitly says, well, Saudi Arabia really does a lot of business with some of our great defense contractors, their offense contractors, that we really need to not muddy the waters with this organization, even though they're committing genocide in Yemen. So we have people at different levels having different interests. The average Joe at Raytheon might say, well, I'm trying to start my small business. Screw the feds for regulating me. Screw them for taking money in my taxes. However, the CEOs are very well in the know that wars are based on either lies of omission or lies of commission. Commission lies would be Saddam is killing babies in incubators, blatant lie. He's buying uranium in Niger, Syrian gas attack, Gaddafi's Viagra. Those are blatant lies to your face. The lies by omission are just to scare the populace. North Korea could nuke us at any minute. Iran is the biggest funder of terrorism, even though Iran was actually fighting ISIS. So you have this sort of interconnected marriage between the military-industrial complex and politicians that allows these things to continue. As far as the excellent point made by Dan, regulations being the lifeblood of keeping competition out, this is a great point made by Mary J. Ruart. Companies can either make money by stifling competition and having the state issue them money, or they could compete in a marketplace providing products and services to a larger number of groups who purchase their items because they value their items more so than they do the currency they've acquired through their own work, which they produce and trade for other things. So you have this web of people constantly creating wealth, increasing the number of satisfactory exchanges. Once a state comes in, well, it throws a wrench in everything. We have two very clear examples, Jay Austin and Elvis Summers trying to build their own houses. These two gentlemen were about to build houses, mini houses for homeless people. That would be about $1,000. With the amount of money the U.S. generates annually in charity, we would have solved homelessness a decade ago. As a causal result of the state regulating how houses are to be built, they forcibly confiscated the houses. This happened both in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. In Los Angeles, it was under the guise of they're stopping us from a poverty solution project that we have that's going to come eventually. So we have blatant examples like that. The Walmart example, yeah, the last three CEOs of Walmart have come out in favor of the minimum wage. That's blatant. We have the Citigroup emails that were released by WikiLeaks. Citigroup Bank issued an email to Barack Obama telling him who his cabinet was going to be before he got into office. So we constantly see this feedback loop. As I mentioned earlier, Jacob Schiff funding the Wall Street, the Bolshevik Revolution, Friedrich Engels supporting Karl Marx. We have big business, again, supporting big government, communism, the bourgeoisie. We have Goldman Sachs blatantly supporting Hillary Clinton, giving her $100,000 for a speech. So, yes, big business and big government are the conspiracy marriage made in heaven, unfortunately.
All right. And one of the points that, Robert, you made was the different the hierarchy. And the capos are sort of the guys who make sure that the Don doesn't get any of the heat on him. So the capos are the ones sort of pulling the strings at the, you know, directing the soldiers around. And if I marry that up with what Keith was just saying with the email from Citigroup, that the president is almost like a capo. And so we're not supposed to see the Dons pulling the strings above them, which is, I guess, is the deep state and the corporate state, like the big banks and those types of things. So it's a way of like shielding themselves, using their structure to protect the different various elements. And they'll have different perspectives on probably what they're aware of and what they would object to when it comes to regulations and state involvement. Now, Robert, did that kind of answer your question a little bit?
Yeah. Excellent, gentlemen. Both of you. Is there anything else we want to touch on? I know we're moving on, getting long in the tooth here.
Yeah, we are getting a little bit long, and I wanted to touch on Cuba just a little bit because this is, of course, part of the plot of Godfather 2, where Michael is in an agreement with Hyman Roth, and he ends up getting double-crossed. But the whole point of them is to move their some of their operations to Cuba to find a more friendly jurisdiction to their business, as the United States is getting more and more difficult to work with the government there. They were looking for a friendlier confine. So they're sort of shopping around with their feet and finding a more I guess, lucrative market in Cuba. Like, they would basically be allowed to get away with a lot more stuff with a lot less hassle. However, the backdrop to this is, of course, the Cuban Revolution that's happening in the background during this time period in Godfather 2. And, you know, coincidentally, they just happen to be there during some of the rebel fighting. And one of the points that Michael makes is, I saw these rebel guys willingly die to move their cause forward an inch. There is no way that they're not going to win. They're willing to do anything to win. And so I guess that brings up the whole Cuba thing. So
the whole Cuba thing
in the movie, where they were looking for a more friendly jurisdiction, but then also the backdrop was there was all this resentment for this corrupt government, this crony government that was there, that was friendly to these Western interests. And there was revolution, and the people who believed in that revolution, the useful idiots who were willing to die to move it ahead a little bit further, they were in a position to win because they were willing to die for it.
Yeah. And I tend to think that Hyman Roth, who had big time connections and friends with the sitting president, right? He was more like willfully ignorant. I don't necessarily think he was trying to really scam his business partners out of their investment. It seemed to me that he had established these relations and he was just kind of hoping against hope. Maybe he just didn't understand the nature of the truth on the ground that Michael saw, but I find it hard to believe that Michael's there for like a day and he figures it out more than Hyman Roth does. I mean, maybe Hyman Roth was kind of like in a bubble and he's like a little insulated in Havana, you know, just not really knowing what's going on. But if he's there to invest, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars, to not know that there's this major uprising happening and the whole apple cart could get upset any minute, it seems to be just like bad business tactics, right? You want to know how stable the business, you know, these contracts that you're going to be writing are going to even be enforced. All this money that you're investing isn't just going to get stolen, which is why we see, you know, all kinds of capital flight out of socialist and communist countries, or countries that go more and more socialist and communist. Because if you're not going to invest millions and millions of dollars into these projects only to have the state, you know, make them public, just steal them. So, you know, then of course the corporations get vilified for leaving after, you know, we stole your property and now you're leaving. How dare you? But, you know, it seemed to me that Hyman Roth wasn't as good of a businessman as he should have been or otherwise seemed to be. I don't know why Michael was necessarily working with you. Is that terrible? I don't know. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I was confused by the whole Hyman Roth thing. And I think that it sort of convoluted the movie, especially in contrast to the very straight linear arc of the ascension of Vito. Because if Hyman Roth tried to kill Michael and failed because he shot up his office on Lake Tahoe, and then he wants him to invest like $4 million in Cuba, and he's like really hot for the money to get there. But didn't he just try to kill him? So there would not have been this money. And so why is it a big deal that he gets this money? And then what's he going to do? Kill him then after he gets the money? But wouldn't that be tied up in contractual arrangements and not necessarily like flow to him? I mean, it just seems like I don't understand what Hyman Roth was trying to pull off.
Yeah, this is why I don't understand people that say that the second movie is the best of all time compared to the first one. I think the first one tells a much more clear narrative. The audience can actually understand what the hell's going on. You're not dealing with Michael, the master chess strategist, who never explains anything to the audience. So when he says one thing, you're like, did he really mean it? Is that true? Is that what he's really thinking? I don't know. So I didn't understand, like you're saying, with the whole Hyman Roth, why try to kill him if he wants his money in Cuba? It makes a whole lot of zero sense, or at least it's not explained to the audience.
Yeah. Unless it was perhaps like not intended to kill him. It was just to scare him, to make him want to not be in the US anymore or more apt to invest in Cuba. I don't really know.
Or it wasn't Hyman Roth to begin with. I don't know. I still don't know the whole plot of that movie, and I've seen it a couple times. I don't know who did what. Even when Michael kills them all at the end, I'm like, okay, well, you killed all your enemies. Okay. Does that mean who did what? I still don't know.
Yeah. I did like how the flourish at the end where they're all kind of simultaneously killed, like just how cinematically that's presented. It's like a kind of closes it out nicely. It's like time to the music and all that.
Yeah.
But anyway, you're right. We are getting a little bit long, and this is the second time we've talked about this series of movies. So, yeah, are there any final points anyone wants to make before we get into final summary and review? And let's give a review for all three of the movies. So we're going to give three different scores. I know it's a lot of work, but you're willing to put in the time, I'm sure. You've already put in 3 hours talking about this movie series. So any final notes that anyone wants to bring up?
No, man. I burned through my notes a long time ago, so.
All right. Well, then, Robert, why don't you give us your final summary review for part one, part two, part three, and three scores, please, sir.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, I think the first two books were adapted from the original just Godfather book, as I understand it. So it's I really take that movie as a part one and part two of a single story, and then Godfather Part Three is the separate thing. I don't think it was adapted from the book. I think the first movie is the best. I think it tells almost a complete story. Although the second movie is, if you were to just combine the first and second movie, it'd be super long. It'd be like a 6 hour movie or whatever. And it'd be crazy, but that tells a complete story. If as it is, the second movie is just like this bad guys doing bad stuff. It doesn't really have a character arc per se. It ends kind of the same way the first one does. I don't know. It's just like sad Michael. And then the third one starts off with sad Michael. It ends with sad Michael. I don't really understand the whole, even the point of that movie. Maybe the 30th anniversary cut will answer some questions or make more of a point. I don't know. But for me, the first movie is like a 9. I think it's fantastic. It's everything you'd want in some kind of a mob story. The second movie, still good, but is more of a continuation of the first movie, bookending that story, completing Michael's arc, or at least life story in general. I would say that's like a 7.5. I just don't think it's as good. It's obtuse. You got this, like I said, guy that about people that keep everything to the chest, close to the chest. They don't reveal anything. So when they actually do reveal something, are they telling the truth? Who knows? It's still compelling. It's still, you know, entertaining. It's still good, but it's just not quite the complete story that the first one is. The third movie, it's still set in the same universe. All this, you know, a lot of the same characters, or the second generation of those characters. Not quite as compelling. It ends with, you know, sad Michael again. Not as good. I'd say it's more like a 6.5, but still. You know, so I'm going to go 9, 7.5, and then now I'll just say 6, 9, 7, 5. Is that splitting? I think that's splitting it perfectly.
That's pretty good. Yeah, that's a pretty good split. I'm actually surprised that 3 is so close to 2, because I would hold 2 in higher regard, like by more of a margin. But I will agree with you that I think that the first one is probably the best one. And I think it has a lot to do with, you know, having an actual story, an actual arc. And having something to say, you have this evolution of the character in Michael becoming this, by the end of it, you know, this mafioso type Don guy, but he's this wide eyed, you know, young guy at the beginning. And you see him go through all these tribulations and assume the mantle. But by the time we get to the second movie, it's sort of weird. It's like, it's almost like the first movie and the second movie is almost the trilogy, could be a trilogy of its own. Like if you had the Ascension of Vito as its own standalone movie. And then you had Godfather 1, which would be the second part of that. And then you had the Hyman Roth situation be the third part. Then you would have this continuous arc. So I know that Coppola like intentionally did this sort of reversing Ascension, Descension narrative structure in Godfather 2, and he was taking a risk. And a lot of people think it paid off, but I think it kind of didn't. It sort of made it even more convoluted, especially when you contrast it with the straightness of the Vito story and then just how convoluted the Michael story was. And sometimes you couldn't even, like, the cuts were just so quick. Like, you couldn't tell, like, why we're all of a sudden, you know, back in Hell's Kitchen in 1917, and now all of a sudden we're in Cuba or whatever. Like, it was just very startling. And then 3, yeah, I think it was just, He needed some cash, and it was a bankable property. But I don't think that a lot of people disavow Godfather 3 as even existing. Hopefully this 30th anniversary edition will be like the Snyder cut for Justice League, and will be the actual vision that Coppola had in mind. And hopefully it adds an additional artistic flair to it and makes it be close enough to the other two to actually be considered in the same conversation. But I will agree with your ratings for the most part. I'll go with a 9, an 8, and then a 5. So that's my score in descending order. And we'll go over to Keith.
Well, I would say the first movie is probably my favorite movie of all time. Just because I've watched it so many times, I would have to give it a 10. I mean, if that movie is not a 10, then a 10 just doesn't exist. I would give part two a 9.5. I'm not able to determine, because I haven't studied cinema in depth as I would like to, I'd have to give it a 9.5. I do feel like it's missing that connection with the characters that you really get in part one. You really like Sonny. You feel bad for Michael. You want to see the Don succeed. You're wondering what, you know, Tom Hagen's role is and everything. You don't get that as much in part two. However, part two is still, you know, better than absolutely 95% of the movies that I see today. That's my justification in giving it a 9.5. Part three, I really don't even remember. I think I saw it 5 years ago, and I'd give it like a 5. It's not really on my radar. You know, certainly it doesn't touch Goodfellas, Casino, those sorts of movies. So finally, I'd say, part one is a 10, part two, 9.5, and part three, I'd give a 5.
All right. All three harsh critics on the third one, but pretty appreciative of the first two. So I think all around we're all in a fair amount of agreement, and we had a lot of really good discussion based on this. And so, Keith, I appreciate you coming on again and being willing to come back a second time to talk about the same property. And I use property in a air quotes kind of way. But speaking of another property we're going to be talking about next week, we're going to be doing RoboCop with our buddy Mike Z. He will be back again. He was last on for Heat a couple weeks ago, another De Niro movie. And RoboCop is one right up his alley. And so I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And we always have a long conversation with him. So if you guys aren't already Patreon supporters, where you get the pre-show and post-show bonus content, be sure you get it before next week, because we usually do these mammoth, like, 4-hour recording sessions with Mike with plenty of things to talk about. It's always a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Mike's a great guy.
All right. Just like you are, Keith. So why don't you remind everyone where they can find what you do? And then if you can stick around for a little bit longer, we can do some more bonus content with you as we go into the evening here.
Yeah, please check out my channels, Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. I am on YouTube, Library, BitChute, Minds, and Archive.org. I am Keith Knight 13. I'd appreciate it if you at least subscribe to those, so I have a backup for when I get kicked off of YouTube. I was restricted on my recent Bin Laden video, which was like the most appropriate thing I've ever come out with. So that just tells me that the algorithm is certainly picking up keywords on YouTube. Please subscribe to me, as well as, you know, your fellow voluntarists, so we at least have a backup for when YouTube goes into its full censorship mode. Thank you guys so much for having me on, and I appreciate the time of the listeners.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And hit that like and subscribe and smash that bell icon, everyone. And we'll see you guys next week as we talk about RoboCop. And you can find show notes more for this episode at lastnighters.com/143 and also on the Launchpad Media. And with that, we'll say goodnight from Last Night, everyone. Peace out. All right, we're going to continue for just a few more minutes on the Actual Anarchy podcast before we get into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is bonus content. So this is still episode 200 of the show, and usually I like to save a pretty good question for this. And Robert, in the pre-show, you wanted to talk more about Finucci. So what was the aspect about Finucci that you wanted to talk about? There was one scene where he goes into the meat shop that Vito's working at, and through a nepotism kind of play, he gets Vito's Vito fired so that his job can be made available for his nephew. So that was a way of, you know, Finucci going around, not only extorting people for protection money, but also sort of pushing them around and forcing people to give favors to him that aren't necessarily in their best interest otherwise.
Okay, so here's the thing I wanted to talk about Finucci. And hopefully my internet holds up. You keep glitching out on me. I apologize. So Finucci, so the boys, Vito's got this gang of these two other guys, and they rob like some dresses or some merchandise of some kind of a truck. And Finucci gets wind of it. And he says, you know, I'm kind of like the Don around here. You kind of owe me a cut for the privilege of doing business or stealing from people in this area or what have you. It's a very common mafia thing. People claim ownership over an area. And if any kind of theft is happening in that area and was operating in that area, they owe the local lord like a cut of the profits of the merchandise that they steal. So Vito, you know, his two accomplices, they go, let's pay him the cut. Let's pay him the money. That's what you do. We got to operate here. He's a very powerful, influential guy. We don't want to piss him off. We'll just pay him a cut and we'll just go about doing business. And Vito's like, yeah, we could do that, but, or I could, you know, you can give me, you know, a smaller amount and then I'll offer it to him and then he'll just take it. And they're like, well, this sounds like a crazy idea. Why would you do that? And he's like, trust me, I'm really good with people, you know, give me this money and then I'll take care of it. Kind of like doing a service for his two accomplices, right? So they give him like, I think it was like $100 each or $200 each or whatever it was. And then he meets Finucci in this shop and he gives him like even less, like, I forget what it was, but it was like even less than he said he was going to give him. And Finucci is like, you know, I admire your balls. You know, if you ever, maybe I'll find some work for you to do. You know, he kind of respected Vito. And then Vito, like, it's all happening during this like parade. And then Vito, you know, goes and murders him, goes and just kills him and then robs his body. And my question for you was, does he owe his business partners a cut or first of all, their money back? Or, you know, or did he provide a service to them that is fully justified? And then Vito is like, I mean, besides the fact that he murdered the guy, let's just get that out of the way. Even though I don't even know, maybe he's being threatened and coerced by Finucci. So maybe he's somewhat justified in killing the guy. I don't know. But does he owe the money that he took from his business partners back to them is my question for you, Daniel. And then Keith also.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, in one respect, Vito is essentially offering them a competitive alternative offer, though he's couching it in terms of, I'm going to go and, you know, pay this money to Finucci. So he's sort of like misrepresenting what he's intending to do, because I think he's hatched this plan that he's going to kill Finucci. So in a way, he's becoming the Don. He's accepting a lower price for the protection money from these guys, and he's going to go take care of the big problem at this and thus kind of take his spot of extorting these guys, but at a lower rate.
Right.
So that's kind of how I read it.
He's becoming the Finucci. He's taking Finucci's place by providing this service to them to accept
at a lower
less.
Price. So
right. He's like, I'll be the discount Finucci in this situation. Right.
Right, but he doesn't like openly say that. But yeah, that's essentially
right.
I think, what he does.
But once he kills Finucci and gets the money back, does he owe it back to his customers? I guess you're saying no.
In that particular instance, I would say no. And then if he were to continue to demand payment from them, I think it would be more of like a tribute or an appreciation to them, like a respect thing from them to him for taking care of this problem for them.
Okay. Keith, you got anything to add to that?
I would say this appears to be a total breach of contract. If you say, give me X property in exchange for Y service, and you don't perform Y service to the extent to which there was an understanding, you do have to give the property back. I would say that's my immediate idea of what a contract would uphold. The fact that he's also providing a different type of service, screw you. That's not part of the contract. The fact that my security organization walks around a neighborhood and provides a general amount of security, as I do with all my guns, that doesn't give me the right to take money under false pretenses. So I think that's totally illegitimate.
Okay, so he deserves, he owes this money back to his guys because he didn't actually perform the service that he said he was going to do.
Correct. They paid that money with the assurance it would be given to him under general circumstances in which they would then be seen as good creditors and people who had paid their debts to which they owed.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Now, I don't recall. Do we actually know what happens as the resolution of that? Because I'm sure that the amount of money that those guys paid him wasn't that big of a deal. So having Finucci out of the way would have allowed Vito and his compatriots to then sort of assume the Finucci position in the community and have the money rolling in, be able to do, you know, the work that they were doing before, but with less things inhibiting them. So wouldn't the amount of money that was in play here actually be small potatoes? So he could have paid them back and they would have all, you know, still ended up profiting more so than had Finucci still been around.
Right. Right.
Yes. However, as we learned from the first scene in Godfather Part 1, it is not about the money. It is about friendship and keeping your word. As Johnny Cochran tells us, nothing is more important than credibility. The fact that this that Vito does not rely on credibility for his first major transfer of property, which is his first contract, is very indicative as to, you know, him not being reliable. Of course, what happens in the future, we don't know until, you know, Godfather Part 1, when he's much older. I still don't think he is justified in violating the trust of people who delegated money to him. So, therefore, I believe he is unjustified and owes them restitution.
Okay. Now, do you think that there's a possibility that there was a subtext, like, I'll take care of it? I'll make him an offer he can't refuse.
Totally. That there might have been. But because we don't know that... That's my current. That is my current position on what happened. But I'm happy to be proven wrong by more info being introduced.
Yeah, right, so I didn't get the sense in that meeting at that dinner table that that was the subtext. I didn't read any subtext. I read it as a couple of young hoods earnestly having a conversation, and that they kind of trusted Vito to handle it diplomatically. But
okay,
I don't know.
But Vito must have known, like, what he was going to do, and he was confident in his ability to pull it off.
Yeah, I think he had a plan for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, a little minor disagreement at the end of the show here. So finally, three guys, we're not just three guys agreeing with each other, which is normally what we do on the show. All right, well, very good. Well, Keith, thanks again, and we'll end the Actual Anarchy podcast here, and we'll continue on with some Kathleen Turner Overdrive after this. But everyone can find you at Don't Tread on Anyone. Sorry about saying it incorrectly at the beginning. I should know better than that. I'm also very tired. But this has been episode 200 of the show. You can find the show notes more on actualanarchy.com/200. If you want to buy any merchandise that helps support my co-host, Robert, you can go to Trubster.com, and that redirects to his TeePublic site that has various designs. And I think on the previous episode, you alluded to maybe you would be developing some new, more relevant stuff due to present day events. So I look forward to potentially seeing some of that.
Well, I should. I think I chided myself for not doing it, because there are a whole bunch of softballs out there in the libertarian / voluntarist free market world of merchandise. I don't know, that might be Kyle Rittenhouse themed, could be McCloskey themed, could be all kinds of themes, but I am just not taking advantage of all those opportunities. And I should, but I've got quite a bit on my plate at the moment.
That's right. You've got your restaurants, entrepreneurial endeavors, and this here show. So your plate is pretty full, I think. And we'll be full next week talking about RoboCop with our buddy Mike C. And in the meantime, check out Keith Knight's stuff. And we'll see you guys all next week. Maximum freedom, everyone.
the chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.